Welcome to the New Books in Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Carrie Figter. In our bi-monthly podcast, we talk to philosophers about their newly published books. Today, I'll be talking with Professor John Christman. His book, The Politics of Persons, has just come out in paperback with Cambridge University Press. John Christman is professor of philosophy, political science, and women's studies at the Pennsylvania State University. Contemporary political philosophy is fundamentally concerned with justice, freedom, equality, and authority. In developing theories of such matters, political philosophers often rely upon distinctive, yet often tacit, conceptions of the self and individual autonomy. Familiar forms of liberal political theory are sometimes criticized for assuming an objectionably atomistic or disembodied view of selves. Traditional liberalism envisions self-interested and self-sufficient rational deliberators who enter into social relations only after performing very sophisticated calculations of the costs and benefits of doing so. According to a long-standing tradition of criticism, this image of the self is objectionably blind to the social nature of human subjectivity. On these views, selves are fundamentally relational. They emerge out of particular social and historical contexts. Accordingly, on these views, traits which traditional liberalism aspires to ignore or discount, traits such as gender, ethnicity, and physical ability, become central to political theory. Yet, as Christman argues in his book, opponents of liberalism have not yet managed to develop a viable political theory, an alternative to liberalism. And moreover, Christman thinks that there is a version of liberalism that can recognize the social, relational, and historical dimensions of selves. In The Politics of Persons, Christman develops and defends a kind of liberalism that places at its center a distinctive conception of individual autonomy rooted in a socio-historical conception of the self. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, John Christman.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Thanks for including me. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. So welcome to New Books in Philosophy. My guest today is John Christman. He's the author of the book The Politics of Persons, which was published in paperback this year with Cambridge University Press. This book is centrally aimed at developing a conception of the self and a theory of individual autonomy that gives proper weight to the social and historical dimensions of human agency. Along the way, Christman addresses many of the central issues in moral and political theory. So it's a very wide-ranging book. It's philosophically very rich. So, John, why don't we begin, before we get to talking about the meat of your book, with a little biographical information. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself or how you came to philosophy or how you came to develop this longstanding, as I understand, interest in autonomy?
Yeah, sure. And first of all, thanks very much for having me. This is a very interesting series you have, and you conducted very well. So thanks for including me. I grew up in New Orleans, which in the last few years has become a poignant fact about me and my family. But went to college, finished at the University of New Orleans. And the only thing interesting about that, besides the fact that New Orleans is and always has been a fascinating place, is that I've realized more and more how coming from there and going back there quite often recently, it gives one a sense of history and a sense of a kind of the weight of history on the present, and even
sure.
when it suffers a certain rupture, as it did recently there.
Right.
But in terms of training, I was a major in philosophy and English. I loved reading literature, and I. But a place like the University of New Orleans, which is not known as a university broadly, it had a wonderful small philosophy department, and I had this great advantage of being, you know, a philosophy major, and also I worked in the office, so I got a lot of attention. And I don't know if it was the case with you, Bob, but when I got to know professors, I got to know them as friends, and as I got to know what it's like to be a professor and not just you know, my head in philosophy as a discipline, sure. but right. really got to know the profession and realized that's what I wanted to do. So then I went to graduate school in Chicago at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and did a dissertation. I studied with Jerry Dworkin, though I didn't write on autonomy, he being famous for that and eventually very influential on for me. But I wrote on property and distributive justice.
Right.
And that resulted in a book. And my work over the years has always had these sort of two prongs, one concerning, you know, distributive justice and issues of economic rights and economic justice, and theories of autonomy and the self and freedom. And often that overlaps. But those have kind of leapfrogged each other in terms of prominence. But then I got a position at Virginia Tech and was there for 11 years or so, and then have moved to Penn State, where I am now, and have been now for, goodness, 13 years. So
wow, time flies.
I know, it's amazing. It's sad.
I often wonder, you know, if there isn't something to be said just as far as the sort of sociology of the profession goes, mm-hmm. because like you, you know, I did my undergraduate philosophy major at a small college mm-hmm. In New Jersey, mm-hmm. William Patterson. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were maybe six or seven other philosophy majors at the time I was there, all of whom now are tenured philosophy professors. Mm-hmm. And so there is something about being introduced, at least starting your philosophical education might be the better way to put it, mm-hmm. in a liberal arts smaller context that mm-hmm. might lend itself to you know, a kind of introduction to the profession that you can't get in other. And other kinds of institutions, but mm-hmm. It seems to me that the business you're talking about your own introduction into professional philosophy by getting to know your professors in a way that helped you to understand what you know, what the life of a professor is like, or what the mm-hmm. academic life is like. I think that's really an interesting observation and very a key, I'm sure, point and or element of the history of lots of professional philosophers. Mm-hmm. So very interesting. Let's talk about the book.
Okay.
One thing I want to sort of commend you for is, you know, the politics of persons is refreshingly ambitious. As a work of moral and political philosophy in a time where a lot of work is very tightly focused on a very specific, narrowly construed topic. A lot of the way typically things go is a lot of the work done in the book is sort of, you know, holding off related issues and trying to, you know, sort of narrow things down to some very particular P that you're mm-hmm. trying to assert. The politics of persons is different. That is, that it's ambitious and that it takes on a lot of different sorts of philosophical concerns and tries to, you know, work its way through a number of issues that philosophers tend to think should be kept separate. Mm-hmm. So I applaud that. I think that was one of the really engaging aspects of the book. Mm-hmm. You know, on one point you're talking about sort of psychological conceptions of the self and work in psychology. There's good discussions in there about issues in practical reasoning. So you really bring a lot of stuff together. Identity politics and multiculturalism come up later in the book. So there's a lot going on, a lot of moving parts. So maybe a good way to begin would be just to ask you to give us a statement about how you see the main project of the book, how you see these different parts working together. Or is there was there one element that you would call the central project of the book and the other things sort of are playing supporting roles? Mm. Why don't you give us sort of a discussion of the how you conceptualize the overall aim of the politics of persons?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, thanks for those comments. You're right that it takes a sort of expansive approach to these issues. But at the same time, I have great respect for the folks who pare issues down very carefully. And
sure.
I always hope I can say something careful about the big issues. But the central theme of the book is to ask the question of what conception of the self or autonomy it remains plausible when we take seriously the variety of critiques of the Enlightenment conception of the person that we inherit in liberal political philosophy, where that traditional conception has the person as a free, rational chooser, unencumbered by social position, often completely divorced from his or her history, and just chooses her, his ends and values as if from a menu. And often, and so over from a number of traditions and over many years, that understanding of the self in society has become controversial and problematic. And in many circles in the broader philosophical landscape, it's completely rejected and in some places ignored. And so the central theme of the book is to ask, if we take seriously the critiques from a number of directions of that model of the self, what conception of an independent, authentic agent in society with a history can we construct that would play a role in a theory of politics, in democratic theory and democratic society, in the way that we think a theory of the person ought to do. And so in some ways it is negotiating this middle way between a complete rejection of the Enlightenment conception of the rational agent, and that emerges from a variety of places, and the uncritical holding on to that traditional understanding of the person. So, it's an attempt. The central, purpose theme of the book, and it's literally the center of the book, is a theory of autonomy, right, where I, join many other voices here, not the least of which is my former teacher, Jerry Dworkin, but many other people who have been talking about that concept, and I fashion in analytic style a conception and have several conditions and try to defend it against criticisms, but then have that as a linchpin be the what I want to build a broader conception of politics on the one hand and the self from a psychological and social point of view on the other. So in some ways the book is just about autonomy, but in other ways it's about autonomy as it can be reconstructed in this broader landscape of social critique and political theory.
Right. So I want to ask you about the actual details of the conception of autonomy. But first, just picking up on some of what you just said, in reading the book, sort of a question emerged for me early in reading it that's kind of methodological or we might say second order. Mm-hmm. Because it seems it seems that you've just affirmed that you've got a specific view about the relation between our conceptions of the self and our view of autonomy on the one hand and our overall political theory. That is, I take it from reading the book that you see your task as at least in part that of devising a view of the autonomous self that would be comfortable or friendly with a certain kind of political framework, a certain roughly familiar kind of, again, modified but still roughly liberal political framework. Now, I take it that this is novel in that theorists, especially people dealing with autonomy, tend to read the politics off the theory of the autonomous self. That is, the task typically is to get autonomy right and then understand our politics as or a political theory as something that's supposed to respect that or preserve it or enable it. And so you do autonomy first and then the politics sort of trails after it. You design the politics to suit it. But it seems to me that you're working with a sort of bidirectional model here in that you're committed to a certain kind of political project and you're trying to fashion a conception of autonomy that would still be comfortable with that project and yet take on what you see as worth taking on from critics who might not share that political framework. Does that seem right?
Yeah. And I think what the motivation there is a certain unease with a way of doing moral philosophy that some people do extremely well, but I've never really fit myself into comfortably, and that is where we consider concepts like autonomy, something so full of connotations and implications, and try to analyze it as if it's a kind of freestanding entity that we're trying to get the edges of, and we test our intuitions and we ask, well, is this plausible and does this make sense? What about this example and this counterexample? And it occurred to me a long time ago that that process is kind of inert when we divorce it from the role that the concept is intended to play in practical and political context, either theoretical or practical in policy, for example. And so I realized that we have to ask these questions about what does this word mean, autonomy, while at the same time asking what role does the definition of that word play in some broader project. And so the relationship between conceptual work and theory building, to me, was always a tight one. Now, you can't spell it out. You know, you always have to ask where the cart is and where the horse is. And I never want to say I'm just going to define a conception of the self or autonomy that will serve this political purpose that I've already, you know, set out or cottoned on to. But at the same time, I just don't think we can ask ourselves in philosophical conversation, what is a self or what is an autonomous self, and then settle that question as if that has no context and that has no, you know, we're not asking it from a particular historical and even geopolitical point of view, and then say, okay, now that's settled, good, and then what can we build on that? I just don't think that works, because there are too many disagreements in that kind of literature. We just come to a dead end, and you think, well, my intuitions are not fully laid out because I have to see what the implications of this are. And so I'm not a Rawlsian in any official sense, although I may be a kind of fellow traveler in many senses. Clearly, what I'm doing here is a kind of reflective equilibrium,
right?
In that I want the conceptual work on an idea like that to always be in conversation with the politics it'll support and the metaphysics and psychology it arises out of, but understanding that all of those nodes can give and take until we have a picture, the whole of which seems to make a certain sense and can be plausible.
Well, excellent. And does this, I mean, I can see how your positive view, again, which is an attempt to take on board sociological or social and historical aspects and of the self and of human agency, I could see how the more standard methodology, get autonomy right, then figure out what the political world should look like, wouldn't fit well with that positive conception of how things are. Because if, after all, social stuff and historical stuff figures into our best accounts of who and what we are and how we reason, then it would seem that methodologically you'd have to pursue the line that you're pursuing quite well. But does this also figure into these sort of methodological considerations, figure into some of the thoughts that come up a little bit later in the book? I know I'm skipping ahead. Okay. About ideal versus non-ideal theorizing. So you've got a lot of interesting things to say there. And I take it that that this is another crucial sort of linchpin of your philosophical methodology. So can you speak a little bit to that?
Sure. Attention to and an embrace of what's come to be called non-ideal theory had really become more robust as I worked through the project. In that I had always been skeptical of this method by which we just talked about, where we can somehow in some pristine way settle an issue on a concept or even what we ourselves are, just thinking about self-concept and selves, that somehow can be settled. Always been skeptical of that, but at the same time, in an increasing way, sensitive to the way that theorizing about such things abstracted from the very real limitations that all of us face, and some of us face to a profound degree, limitations in social life, limitations in self-knowledge, limitations in the ability to find and pursue flourishing lives, and realize that is the mark of what people have come to call non-ideal theory. And now the sort of tightrope that one has to walk that I find very difficult, not sure I always keep my balance between just merely describing our imperfect world as if we can capture that as easily as we can some ideal, and taking seriously the imperfections while working out some normative models that can then aid in the critique of those very imperfections. And you'll notice, even by the way I'm saying this, there's always the threat of circularity in non-ideal right. theory, in that we say, let's talk about, this will make it obvious, let's talk about the injustices of the world before we have a theory of justice.
That's right.
So, but as you're, you know, noting, the more I work through the project of trying to conceptualize cells and autonomy for the purpose of politics, I realized the way in which I was taking on board limitations and imperfections, not only in society, but in cells. So right. to give a quick example, and this was a result of kind of an exchange in the literature over time, and I benefited greatly from critics early on, where many models of the self in various areas of philosophy assume self-knowledge, right? Assume right. self-transparency. And you don't have to be a doctrinaire Freudian to think that that's implausible, right? Right? I mean, we from the limits of rationality that would become very familiar, to just the role of emotion and other kinds of aspects of our physical and mental lives play in whatever self-conception we can construct at a time. And that's always an imperfect and process that's a matter of struggle and a matter of kind of fits and starts. And, you know, to take another example, often in the analytic literature on these issues of the body never come up. Right. It never sounds like we're embodied beings, where much of the aspects of our physicality are, first of all, unchosen.
Right.
We don't choose how many feet we have yet, and quite markedly, how many feet we happen to have. And many people, through various reasons, don't have 2 feet, right. Profoundly affect our life projects. Right. And so we're constantly adapting and reconstructing a self-concept in a framework, and in this example, a physical framework, but often also a social framework and others that we cannot choose and always have to negotiate our way through. So if you think of it that way, then we're already in the realm of what we're now calling non-ideal theory. We, you know, the idea of a, you know, freestanding, choosing rational agent becomes just untenable as a starting point. But then talking about this tightrope, to fall right. off the other side of it would be to say we're so hopeless, we're so right. self-deluded that not only articulating our own self-understandings as persons, but also theorizing about this is all, you know, a kind of fool's errand. Now, right. I don't want to accept that, because then I think normativity falls away as well, and so does critique, and so does the project of political philosophy. And so then the question is, how can we accept these sort of structural, I don't even want to call them limitations because they're ubiquitous, the right. structural framing of our self-understandings and our social life and our politics, while at the same time leaving room for, you know, normative and theoretical critique?
Well, again, well done. Let's get to the actual heart of the book. Okay. You promote a distinctive view of autonomy, and what I regard as a highly philosophically nuanced view of the self. Again, the tightrope metaphor that you mm-hmm. were just speaking about sort of pervades the book, and that you're constantly trying to sort of navigate various kinds of conflicts between two poles that you think are both in a way unacceptable or excessive. Mm-hmm. Much of the book then is devoted to this project of clearing a conceptual space for a view of the self and autonomy that, as you were just saying, resists the problematic features of what you were just calling the so-called enlightenment or traditional or atomistic view mm-hmm. Of the self. While also avoiding sort of excessively socialized or what, you know, we used to call communitarian alternatives. So can you describe for us then in a little bit more detail some of your dissatisfactions with these more traditionally liberal, some would say atomistic views, mm-hmm. And your dissatisfactions with the more, what I take it you regard as excessively socialized or communitarian conceptions of the self, and then give us a description of your own positive thesis with respect to the nature of the self and the sort of socio-historical conception of autonomy that falls out of that conception.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the traditional liberal conception, and I realize as I kind of describe this, it may be a caricature. It may be that no one, in fact, held this, though we can argue about whether that's true. Right. But the view I'm thinking of is the conception of the self as primarily agent or chooser, that a being who, from a position divorced from ends and purposes, can choose values, ends, and purposes. And in doing so, can abstract from any contingent connections, either, as it were, synchronically to other beings and social settings in one's current landscape, and from the past, from history, that the ideal chooser, and this is coming from a certain reading of Kant, but of course it's a very simplified reading, that the ideal chooser is one who can then consider not only the moral law, as Kant insisted, but also just values that one has as an individual from this unembedded position. And that similarly, if you think of that, again, very simplified vision, the interests that attach to such an agent will be a certain order of interests, you know, the interest of independence and separation and the interest in having a wide menu of choices from which to make these commitments and the like. But if you then take more seriously the way in which we are always embedded both currently and historically in unchosen frames of choice, frameworks of choice, then we have to complicate that vision. And then, you know, the order of interest that arise out of that conception of the person changes. So for a quick example, if one understands oneself and finds oneself in one's self-understanding as connected to these deeply important relationships, then a fundamental interest is not independence, but protection of those relationships, right? Maintenance of the relationships. Now, this is commonplace for people who have been reading, you know, sort of the feminist critique of liberalism for a long time, but that's sure. Very much influential to me. And so the question is, what really is, if we want an understanding of autonomous agency that will play some normative role in social life, moral theory and political politics, we have to look more deeply and in more detail at the conception of selves that underlies that conception of autonomy. And so that's what we have to turn to. And then again, we have this sort of traditional understanding which of the self as rational chooser. And that has to be complicated. That's the traditional notion. And right. Now, I should say sort of historically and biographically and in a way to explain these points, I started this project a long time ago in just engaging in the communitarian critique of liberalism.
Right.
And in that critique, this same ground was gone over, and where the in Sandel's words, the unencumbered self was the central character in liberal political philosophy, and that was problematic for many of the reasons I'm saying now.
Right.
The response to that by, famously, people like Will Kimlicka and Joseph Roz and many other people, and Rawls himself in a different way, the response is to say that the liberal self need not presuppose an unencumbered self, that, as Kimlicka put it, we can merely see each one of our ends as subject to revision in a piecemeal way,
right?
One by one. Well, that to me went a great deal toward the movement away from the problematic view that I was describing, but not far enough or not always in the right direction. Because first of all, the ideal that's being held on to is an ideal of choice. And this is a subtle but crucial point, and I sometimes can't hold on to it correctly.
Right.
But and that is the difference between the interest of a person who is not at all alienated or troubled by a connection that he or she has, the interest of that person, versus the interest of a person who is trying to decide on a value or a path and or is alienated from a particular position he or she's in and has to kind of make a change. The right. latter is sort of the assumption, the background assumption against which we construct theories of agency in even the revised liberal idea.
Right.
We always want to say, and Kimlicka and others say something very much like this, the interest of subjecting all of our commitments to critical review is a primary interest in such an agent.
Right.
And that's the part that I don't want to hold on to in that form, because it's just not an interest in all agents. We can put it this way. It is costly to subject your commitments to critical review in some cases. It is not, it's a troubling process. It is, even if you do it in a piecemeal way, I mean, if you think of a religious commitment, in many religious traditions, it is a crisis of faith.
Right.
To ask yourself, should I believe in God in this way, or you know, whatever your religious framework is, that's not something you always want to do. It's not a fundamental interest. It's a crisis, and so I wanted to, it might just be a variation on the revised liberal self, but I wanted to construct a conception that didn't commit us to that primary interest in change. And in critical reappraisal and in separation from any particular end, but have as you were saying, a somewhat more nuanced view where, in some cases, the fundamental interest is continuing acceptance of a commitment or protecting a relationship, or continuing on a path given one's sort of historical trajectory, and so have a conception of the self and agency and autonomy that. Was faithful to those interests that some of us have, and maybe all of us have some of the time.
Right. And just to pick up on this, I do want you eventually to sort of lay out the conception of autonomy. But one of what I thought were a real compelling argument in the book was the way in which you try, or I shouldn't say try, because it seems to me that you succeed, the way in which you argue that memory is crucial for even just sort of day-to-day practical reasoning activities, right? That we don't even have to talk about these deep crisis moments in order to build into or to see that we must build into our conception of the self something a little bit more complex than even the revised Kimlicka conception, where I think you're right that the Kimlicka conception still holds on to the fundamental conception of the self. It just says that it can't, for whatever reason, maybe they're just purely cognitive reasons, right? Can't revise or evaluate everything all at once. Maybe that's just an epistemic limitation. Mm-hmm. But the concept of the self remains the same in the revised Kimlicka view, I take it. And so what you're trying to argue, and I think you argue compellingly, is that, no, when we think even just about everyday matters of practical reasoning, making a plan for dinner might not be the exact example that you give, but you give a sort of very homegrown example. Yeah. You know, to make a plan of any kind, even a very sort of simple kind, there is an aspect of memory and history that gets built in, even if only at the level that you have to remember what the first step of the plan is when you get to the to formulating the last step.
Right.
So it seems that that's a very compelling aspect of the view. So could you fill in a little bit about that story about the role of memory in history?
Yeah, I'd be glad to, because it does lead into the theory of autonomy and the way I want to formulate it. Yeah, it just jumped out at me at one point years ago that theories of practical reason and agency in the literature, in various literatures, in large part talked about agents as if they came into existence 5 minutes ago. And they have a menu of options, but also settled frames practical identities, right? And they're there. And never talked about what you were just describing that is so fundamental to activity, and that is the way in which, as economists say, choices are path dependent.
Right.
You know, where how I got here means a whole a tremendous amount in terms of what I'm where I can go from here. Now, there are grand exceptions to that generalization. Michael Bratman, for example, in his planning theory of agency is a notable one, and many others who talked about the commitment to already established practical trajectories in a theory of agency. But what I wanted to do is look more carefully at not just the way in which choices are path-dependent, but the way in which remembering plays a role, because when I started looking at the psychology of memory, things got even more complicated in interesting ways, because remembering, and here I'm being, of course, very simplified, but is not merely just a replaying of a film of one's past experiences, right? It's a itself a reconstruction of traces of experience, but also framed by semantic and psychological structures. And at any given time, and here I'm talking about autobiographical narrative memory, we remember by reconstructing a plausible story that makes sense of the traces of sense experience that bear on us, and also make a certain current sense. And so even remembering is not just picking up on some unreconstructed morsel that we then use to go forward. It is itself a project of self-construction. So with that in mind, so memory is important, the past is important, memory of the past is important, and memory is an ongoing self-reconstruction. That's sort of what I tried to establish in the chapter on memory and some other things, and picking up on the work of many other people. And that leads into the theory of autonomy. And if there's any aspect of the theory that it's sort of gotten to be labeled or known for, and it's one it shares with other theorists, it's that it's a historical conception of autonomy.
Right.
And so if I could talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, please.
The standard conceptions of autonomy that in the literature, and there are several, although would make a nod toward the past or how one got to the position where one's making an autonomous choice or not, didn't thematize it. And the question of whether you're autonomous in any either single decision or as a person was conceptualized in a way independent of how you got to where you are, both in where your values came from and where your desires and preferences were, how they were, you know, formulated. And many theorists, I wasn't the first one, started just thinking about that and giving counterexamples to that. I mean, in the sense of, you know, if some mad scientist had implanted all these ideas in your head and now you meet all the other conditions of current autonomy, right, that are set out by other people, we clearly wouldn't want to call you autonomous.
Right.
And so then we that motivated the idea that history, one's personal history, in some way has to play a role in the question of whether one is autonomous. Now, here things get sort of subtle, because you can say that history matters, but you have a choice to make as a theorist between whether you think objectively we can set out historical steps that are necessary for autonomous agency, or we can specify the historical steps necessary for autonomous agency from the agent's point of view.
Right.
And I found the former problematic. That is, any external, what I'm now calling objective conceptualization of how agents come to be who they are, is insensitive to the way in which we sometimes adopt unorthodox and even self-constraining processes of self-formation that would violate those objective conditions. But we do it, you know, for our own purposes. So we might subject ourselves to hypnosis to quit smoking, and during the process of that, we lose certain aspects of control over our development of our agency. And the objectivists I'm talking about might want to say that reflective control is necessary for this process.
Right.
And I just can think of so many examples where we suspend that for a time, because it's part of something we need, it's part of a project, it's part of a plan. And I wanted to then go pursue this alternative route to say, whatever, however history matters, it has to be specified in a way sensitive to the current agent's point of view. So it so instead of saying you're autonomous, among other if among other things, you have come to be the way you are in a certain way, I wanted to say you're autonomous if you're not, upon reflection, alienated from the way you've come to be. Right. Right. And so I have this subjectivist conception of the importance of personal history in my conception of autonomy. Now, some people think it's too subjectivist and there are worries there that I try to take care of. But that's a kind of philosophical decision I made and for the reasons I pointed out. So history matters, but it's history at least partially from the point of view of the current agent. And right. Yeah, go ahead.
So can I just ask a question about the non-alienation component. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is something that some of the critics that you were just mentioning say, I'm not sure. Couldn't somebody say that someone might say, look, Chrisman thinks that what really counts in deciding whether, you know, Betty is an autonomous agent is if Chrisman thinks if on critical reflection about her plans and desires and projects and values, however we want to cash that out, Betty can see the historical source of these components of herself, mm-hmm. And not feel alienated by them. Could a critic say, well, but couldn't Betty's conception of what's alienating and not alienating be itself the product of some kind of very sinister manipulation on the part of some past dominator or oppressor?
Well, in some limited way, I want to say yes, and that shouldn't be a problem, but I'm going to spell out those severe limitations and qualifications. The way I have discussions of what I call authentic reflection. So what we're asking, in this case, Betty to do is to reflect on her, the way she had come to be how she is, and do so in a way free of any imposition or pathology or other disruption of reflective capacities. So she has to be able to reflect. And there's lots of things like hypnosis and, you know, drugs and also other conditions that just undercut our capacity to just reflect without contradiction and self-deception and other things. So there's lots of conditions on the kind of reflections we're talking about. And it has to do, and I also have a condition that it has to be reflection over a variety of conditions. So it has to be that she would reflectively accept this past now, and she would do it tomorrow, and she would do it if she were, you know, seated somewhere else. It can't just be that, you know, her cult leader, for example, is hovering over her, and then she accepts the past, because obviously that's a condition that's specialized to that that sort of power relationship. And we'd want to make her reflective acceptance of herself, as we would say, we might say, settled, right? And so we have this sort of conditions of authentic reflection. We have it that it has to be a variety of conditions, so it's a settled reflective position she's in. The other thing is the way in which history matters, on my view, in a along a different but parallel dimension, and that is that it is reflectively accepted by her as part of an ongoing practical narrative. So it's not just something that she now says, I can accept this, but rather I can accept this as a way of going on, as a way of pursuing values and projects that make sense to me. So it has to be, again, accepted as diachronically as an ongoing process. Now, all that said, that does leave room. Oh, one more thing to say. When I talk about alienation, it is not just the weak feeling of being uneasy with something. Right. It's a fairly stringent requirement. One rejects this idea of oneself. One feels it as a constraint. One is motivated to resist it. One is it undercuts
one's ability to kind of formulate more, to have settled motivations. That's when one is alienated. It's a pretty dire condition. You don't want to, you know, be. This is not just mild unease.
Right.
So I wanted to add that. So with all that, and this is something some critics are still bothered by, I want to leave room for the possibility that people can come to accept as part of their self-understanding certain conditions of their past that from an external point of view we might think of as limitations. Now, we can critique as from that external point of view the way in which that person has been victimized. We can point to it and say, that's too bad that you've now come to be the person you are because of, say, that experience in that religious cult, because maybe we think it's unfair that people were subjected to that. But what I don't want us to be able to do, if all these other, what I think are very stringent conditions are met, to say that Betty, in this case, is not an agent anymore. And the reason I want to leave room for that is because when such cases are ruled out, and there are conceptions of autonomy that are sometimes called substantive conceptions, which say that there are certain ways of being which, by their nature, by their substance, undercut autonomy independent of how the person's come to accept it.
Right.
Mine is a proceduralist conception. And when people try to specify that and they say there are certain ways of life which undercut autonomy, the problem I have with that is that, and I talk about some things like this in the book, we can imagine individuals who meet those who can be described that way, who we can no longer, on the basis of those alternative models, count as an autonomous agent. And that has dire consequences for, I think, our politics.
Right.
Because insofar as our politics includes all and only autonomous agents who are not either children or not impaired, in some severe way, or then if and we are saying such people with such commitments are not welcome in our politics because they don't meet our substantive conditions of autonomy, then we, I think, have problematically limited the arena of, for example, collective deliberation that our politics might demand. And I find that very problematic in its implications. So I'm trying to be very careful in holding on to a proceduralist account, a content invariant. It's usually called content neutral, but I realize it's not completely neutral. It's content, widely content invariant, proceduralist conception of autonomy, knowing that it will be open to certain kinds of what people would call counterexamples, but I want to kind of bite the bullet on some of, on them in, by saying there are certain ways of life which are, to an external and maybe liberal perspective, in a broad sense of liberal, look enslaved or look, you know, overly authoritarian. Yet I want to say, if we want to critique that as overly authoritarian, we can't do it in a way that undercuts the agency of the person in question.
Right. So let me just press from a slightly different direction on this alienation condition. Mm-hmm. What you just said was very compelling. But there is a kind of case, and I think you even raise it sort of in the middle of the book where you're talking about the kind of case where I believe it's a person who has some kind of abuse in his or her past, but that abuse or that abuser is also connected to a long term of very successful piano lessons or something. So that so one of the, and as I was reading the book, I'd sort of had these kinds of cases in mind, which one might sort of think of them more broadly as sort of survivor kinds of attitudes, where one sees in one's own history something that one would regard as abusive or manipulative or oppressive, and therefore one feels, even in this more strict sense that you were laying out, not just the attitude that element of the past was yucky, but also actually feels alienated from or resentful and all the other things that might go into alienation from that bit. But then there's also the reflection on that part of the past as the causal occasion or the mechanism by which some virtue was developed,
right?
Or right. something that one embraces in oneself, some kind of resilience or ability to endure and survive. I mean, sometimes Stoics have this sort of element in their view. So that looks as if it's possible to have this sort of two-pronged set or double-pronged kind of attitude towards something. You could feel alienated by it, but then almost in a Nietzschean way say, well, it's the thing that made me stronger, the thing that made me who I am, and I wouldn't want to change that, even though I feel alienated and have all of the attitudes that you're describing as sort of autonomy defeating. So can you, I know that you sort of raise this kind of case and say that it gives you a pause and then you take a swing at it. Have you had any, this seems to me a very fascinating kind of phenomenon and not that uncommon, I should say. Right. Can you speak a little bit about this case, this kind of case and how you might address it?
Yeah. And, it has several features, and so I want to kind of touch on some of them. The main thrust of your question is, I gather, that we can imagine, and in fact observe, cases where a person has a certain attitude toward how they got to be where they are, yet a different attitude on where they are. In other words, they are alienated from the process, but accept the result of that process. Now, one thing I'll say about that is that I changed the formulation of my view from articles I wrote some time ago before the book in response to criticism, in particular by Al Mealy and some others, from saying that in order to be autonomous, one cannot be alienated from the process. That's what I said earlier.
Right.
To what I say now is one cannot be autonomous if one is alienated from one's current commitments in light of the process. So insofar as the bifurcation you described occurs, if the person can accept their current situation, even given how they got there, they're autonomous. Because, I want to give a couple of reasons for that, both just, I think intuitively, people can overcome crisis and overcome abuse and other kinds of things that happen to them. But also, I think that we want to be able to tell the difference between two kinds of cases. Imagine two people who have suffered a tremendous either crisis or accident, say a debilitating accident. Both of them now, they had been ambulatory and now they're, say, quadriplegic. And in the first case, the person is so undercut. In both cases, they are completely altered and they're completely changed in their outlook. Let's say they were both physically active and imagined themselves always exercising in an ambulatory way. Right. They have to completely change that, and all that's changed. In the first case, the person can never really reconstructs some projects that don't involve walking and remains sort of depressed and sort of victimized by the accident. In the second case, the person, and we probably know people like this, have in some ways, despite their always regretful attitude toward the way what happened to them, been able to reconstruct them projects and also their own self-understanding in a way that is pursued, allows them to pursue a certain kind of flourishing. The difference between those two cases are not the difference between how they got there and not even the difference in their attitudes toward how they got there. Both of those are fundamentally alienating and negative. But in the second case, and I want to allow us to call that second kind of person autonomous, that person has in some way accepted or at least begrudgingly taken on their past and the process by which they are where they are and formulated into a meaningful ongoing value trajectory that they can then get behind. And there is a Stoic element to this. I mean, I'm not wholesale with the Stoics that we just accept our what nature gives to us and you know, expunge all desires which are unmeetable. But I do think, I was sort of in a minority here in the literature, but I'm really adamant about this, that we always want to leave room for the way in which people are adapting to circumstances. The idea of the happy or contented slave is sometimes thrown out as this obvious counterexample. Well, if, on your view, if a person's a slave, then, you know, they could in principle be autonomous. So end of story. Well, I think we are always reconstructing ourselves in light of things we didn't choose, and sometimes and often in light of severe disruptions in what we had chosen earlier and what we had thought of ourselves earlier. And so the alienation condition has to be about how our life is going now in light of how we got there. And that was a kind of, that was just, that example was a reason for to support that.
Right, right. Excellent. So let me, if I may, move on to the more political stuff that comes up towards the end of the book. I know that we're taking up a lot of your time, so I want to make sure that we get a chance to discuss again one of the sort of novel components of the view, as I take it, that from the very beginning of the book, and then it gets developed in some detail at the end. You're explicit in that you want to develop an autonomy-based conception of democratic politics. And in particular, you want to promote, or you do promote, a conception of democratic legitimacy that is that has autonomy at its center. Can you tell us a little bit about that part of the view?
In coming back to the theory of autonomy, I use non-alienation as the condition of sort of self-acceptance in the model of individual autonomy. Mm-hmm. And that's to be contrasted with sort of wholesale identification with aspects of oneself, or in the old model of the liberal chooser we've rejected, the idea that we have chosen ourselves. Now, I want to kind of reiterate that, because at the conditions of legitimacy has always, and discussions about those conditions have always, in large part, assumed that for political structures and centers of authority to be legitimate, they have to be subject to the approval / acceptance / choice of those living under them. And those alternatives that I just listed speak to the various alternatives that, you know, we can find in the literature. In fact, if we look at Rawls, he kind of vacillates between whether right. he thinks the overlapping consensus is merely acceptance or somehow celebration, right? Idealizing from one's own comprehensive
perspective. Right. Sometimes it's just acceptability, that it That's could right. be accepted, right?
That's right, acceptability. Yeah. Right. I want to kind of take the insight there of that last formulation and say that legitimacy, I want to weaken the conditions of legitimacy in the same way I tried to weaken the conditions of individual autonomy, that it's a kind of critical acceptance that's required for legitimacy at the social level. Now, what's required for that is a model of collective deliberation through representatives and secondary associations, various things, that allow citizens and citizen groups to object if they are alienated, if they resist. So it's subject to critical objection, but that's a weaker condition than saying must be the product of collective choice. Right. Because again, and keeping with this theme, there are many aspects of what I think are acceptable democratic processes which cannot be described as the product of collective choice. My view is very influenced by Rousseau, and Rousseauian deliberative democracy has sometimes been caricatured and sort of lampooned as only applicable to very small states where everybody knows each other, where we can all get together and choose what, or, you know, produce our general will in face-to-face contact. We all know that that's impossible, and if, you know, the model implies that, it should be rejected. I want to allow this autonomy-based conception of legitimacy to do the work that we want deliberative democratic processes to do by weakening the condition of legitimacy, so it's sort of this critical acceptance which is required. And I think this has a lot in common with other theories in other settings, that avenues toward allowing citizens to have avenues of critique is what is required for legitimacy. I won't go through this, we don't have time, but I'll just point to it. In Philip Pettit's Republican Conception of Freedom, there's an element of legitimacy, which is required, where it is answerability that's required for right. processes to be legitimate, to protect the freedom of the citizens. And there's a parallel idea here, in my view, that it's a kind of subject to critique, but not a product of choice that is required for legitimacy. And I think that protects the view against some criticisms that have been made against Rawls' view of overlapping consensus and some other things. So that's the meat of that particular view.
Well, excellent. At one point, though, I take it that you I just have in my notes here on 239, page 239, that sort of the view that seems to fall, that the legitimacy is a matter of the absence of what you call understandable alienation.
Yeah, right?
That is
right.
That something like, you know, if the principle is something that somebody couldn't. You know, we're tempted here to use Rawls speak and say reasonably reject, right. But it's something slightly different, right? It's sort of something that they could not understandably be alienated from. Mm-hmm. Then there's legitimacy. Well, this has all been very, very helpful and fascinating. So thank you for talking to us about the politics of persons.
Thank you.
So let me just ask my usual final question. What's next for John Christman?
Well, I have moved on. This is going to sound not so – I've moved from autonomy to freedom.
Oh, right.
and which is not a very long journey. I'm working much more on conceptions of freedom, but also in more forthrightly in the from the position of what we were talking about earlier as non-ideal theory. And I'm trying to rethink – various both conceptions of freedom, positive freedom and negative freedom, and the debates that have emerged out of around those concepts, but from a point of view of either the people or their social position of those who are without freedom, right? Who are by all accounts enslaved. And I'm trying to look at contemporary patterns of so-called enslavement, like in human trafficking, as well as historical settings. And just, it's sort of experimental at this point, and kind of rethink the debates of the nature of freedom, but saying, what is it, what is this idea when we're looking at it from the point of view of those struggling to gain it, rather than the point of view of those who already have it and are trying to protect it. And the it in those two phrases, I think, is slightly different. I think the freedom one is aspiring to or doesn't have is different from the freedom the privileged among us already has and wants political structures to protect. So that's the current long-term project.
Well, that sounds very interesting, and I will look forward to hearing more about this and seeing more about it in the journals and hopefully a book at some point in the future. And if there is a book that comes out of this, maybe we'll talk again on New Books in Philosophy. But once again, thank you, John Christman, for talking to us about the politics of persons, and thanks for your time.
Well, thanks very much for having me. It was a real pleasure talking to you, Bob.
Well, thank you. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor John Christman of Penn State University. We've been talking about his book, The Politics of Persons, published by Cambridge University Press. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.